Good morning and welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. We're also pleased to have back here on this program Rick Arch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. We try to have him on here several times a year, generally once a season we try, to answer your questions on car care. If you're having a problem, if you will call in and describe the car, give us the make and the model, and give the best description you can of what's going on, Rick will see if he can do a little diagnosis there and suggest where you might look for a solution. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We will certainly take as many callers as we can. We have some people ready to go. Welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Urbana's first, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I got a car, 1991 Mitsubishi Galant. I've had it into the transmission shop three times. They don't seem to find anything wrong with it at the time I bring it in, and they test drive it, etc. The attempt is to hook up a monitor to it to see if the transmission is slipping. The problem is this, that it's an intermittent problem, which is the worst of all problems, and it seems to gain 1,000 RPMs while, you know, my foot's on the accelerator, the same uniform pressure, etc. And it will sometimes rev up, sometimes rev down, but it only does this on an intermittent fashion. So I can be on the highway, it'll gain 1,000 RPMs, as I say. And then also when I take my foot off and it deaccelerates, the same slippage occurs. It'll downshift 1,000 RPMs. They said the transmission's fine. Do you have any insight? Could there be something else that's causing the problem other than the transmission?
Has the transmission been serviced recently?
Has not been serviced, no.
Well, that would be the first place to start. Get the correct fluid in there.
Oh, by service, yeah. The correct fluid's in there. It still has that pink color, and it's up to the usual, it's up to the level.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, as far as probably what would be the first place to start checking, I would think, with that, would be by monitoring system pressure, where they'd actually hook up a mechanical gauge and monitor the pressure and then drive it on the highway. Sounds like, from what you just said, the highway seems to be duplicated more than in town. Is that?
Only because I'm usually longer on the highway when I am, mm-hmm. But around town it seems to be the case, too. I can go days without it slipping, and then other times it slips, and it varies depending on the gear. Now, they said they did check it out, and the transmission's fine at the at the shop.
At the time?
Yeah, it's fine. There's nothing physically wrong with it.
Right.
And I don't know what all tests they had performed on it. So I'm assuming they're good. They didn't charge me anything, which was great because I've had it back there three times, you know. So I'm a little bit at a loss. I don't know where to start. They said someone else had mentioned something about a computer module or something that might be bad, and suggesting that to the folks at the transmission shop. They said, well, we'll have to have it misperformed and stick the machine on there when it does to see, to account for what's wrong.
Right. Now, this has overdrive?
Yes, it does.
Have you ever driven it not in overdrive?
Yeah, I've driven it without the overdrive, and it also has a power switch on
right.
it. And I played all sorts of games with it.
And that doesn't change anything?
Does not change anything. I've also left it in first gear and driven it, and second gear, and I still get the same, varied performance in terms of the slippage.
Well, at this point, what I would suggest is that a pressure gauge be installed and it be positioned in such a manner that you can observe it while driving.
Pressure gauge.
Right, to monitor system pressure of the transmission. Typically, something like this would be related to the torque converter.
Okay.
But that's the only way it's going to be resolved.
Okay, so I should then go back to the same shop and ask them to...
Just ask them if they might be interested in doing that and say, I'll be willing to drive the car and monitor the pressure and report back to you.
Oh, I see. So I would take it from there.
You would do that.
Oh, yeah, I see. Oh, very good. Very good. Okay. Any other suggestions there? Or?
No, I think that'll give you some direction and give them some direction.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Good luck. On to somebody else here. We'll go to, we have somebody on cell phone in Coles County. We want to get them on line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How are you doing today?
Good.
I've got a 97 Toyota Camry that has begun running ragged. It's like back in the days when we had points and plugs and your distributor cap would get wet, that kind of thing. I changed plugs and plug wires late in the fall, probably have less than 10,000 miles on them. The car ran fine for the most part, although it had a tendency to have one of the plug wires kind of pop up, and then I would push it back down, it'd be okay. This has been doing this for a few weeks now, though. Mostly when after I'm at a stop and go to accelerate, it hesitates and stutters. Once I get up to speed, it seems to run better, but my gas mileage has really gone to pot. Last week, I pulled the wires and pulled the plugs and made sure that they all looked good and checked the gaps on them, put everything back, and it didn't have any benefit. So I'm wondering if you've got any guesses at all.
Well, it's a constant problem now?
I'd say about 80-85% of the time. Sometimes it runs smooth, but that almost seems to be more a happy accident than anything else.
Right. Do you have the ability to check for a vacuum leak? Do you know how to do that?
I don't know how.
Okay. First reaction is, number one, is to try using some fuel injector cleaner that
okay.
you just actually dump in the gas tank. Typically on a Camry, it's one of two things. It's a vacuum leak or it's an injector problem.
Okay.
Because you've already ruled out the plug connectors.
Well, I just went. I had someone who suggested that as well.
Right.
So I put in a bottle of injector cleaner and ran that tank of gas through.
Mm-hmm.
But he said to put it in every other tank for two or three tanks and see how that goes.
Right. Well, if that hasn't helped, then the only way it can be analyzed is to hook the machine oscilloscope up to the engine mm-hmm. and monitor both the ignition and the fuel system to determine which one's at fault then.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. You have before you recommended that for people who have cars that have fuel injection, and now there are a lot that do periodically. I think 4 times
Correct.
A year.
Four times a year.
So every season, basically, mm-hmm. you're suggesting that people do that. Go out and go to a place where you can buy automotive supplies, and you know where you can just go and pick up one of these bottles of things off the shelf, fuel injector cleaners. And your suggestion is when you fill up the tank, put a bottle of this stuff in, and it will help the car
yes,
run
it's
well.
Just preventative maintenance. That's what happens to a fuel injector. It's a very tiny little orifice or nozzle. It's only like 0.004 of an inch hole. So when you shut the car off, there's like a little drip of fuel that just kind of hangs there. And, mm-hmm. of course, with the heat of the engine, it will eventually evaporate. But as it evaporates, it leaves a residue on the tip of the injector. It's kind of like if you go to your end of your garden hose, the little sprayers that you buy. Some of them, when you spray, it kind of all goes off to the right or to the left. Or you know, it's not very atomized pattern. That's exactly what happens to an injector when it gets dirty.
So what you want is a nice,
even
right. spray.
Because what happens when you have big drops of fuel coming off, the engine can't really burn all of that effectively. And then your mileage, of course, drops.
Mm. Okay. So once every season, put a bottle of that
yes.
stuff in there, and that'll help.
Right.
All right. Rick Karch is our guest from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He's here every once in a while. We talk about cars, and if you have a problem, you can call in and talk about it with him, and he'll suggest where you might look for a solution. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Indiana and on line 4.
Hello.
Yeah.
98 Oldsmobile Royale. Straight facts are the battery goes down, you get up in the morning, hop in, nothing. It's been to 3 different places. I've been going to a place for almost 20 years, so I trust these guys. And they said they have checked the alternator, checked the battery, replaced the battery. It seems to be one of the ploys that's always done. And sure enough, it lasted for a little while, then once again. And after a couple of recharges, my wife got been out of shape and thought these guys don't know anything. So I took it to another place that had sort of a reputation in town as finding electrical shorts and cars pretty easily. They did the same thing, said you need a new battery. You can't really check it with the battery like you have now. So we got a new battery. Another 2 weeks, that went down. So I decided I'd take it to a dealership. We don't have an Oldsmobile here now, but we have people who've been in General Motors for some time, Buicks and Cadillacs. They said they'd check the bulletins. They got into it, and they says, well, yeah, that battery you've got's not too good. Probably should have a new one, and we'll run a check on it. Well, almost to the day, 2 weeks later, which was a couple mornings ago, I went out, and no fire at all. So it's back to this dealership, and they're doing a diagnostic study now. And as far as I can tell, the fellows I've been with for 20 years have done everything imaginable, using the, you know, computer hookups and putting the alternator through different tests and the battery, and they can't come up with anything except most likely it's a relay switch. So when you get out of the car and you turn it off in the evening or whenever, it'll listen for some sound, which we've been doing for about 4 months now, no sound. I even got crazy and got into the trunk to see if the light would come on. You know, it came on, but that wasn't what it was. So nobody really knows, and at least they're being pretty honest about it. And I thought that over the years I've been listening to you, you've pulled things out of the air a number of times. I thought maybe you could help me on this one.
Has anybody actually monitored the current draw when it's shut off?
That, unfortunately, I ask those kinds of questions, and I get these looks like, of course, sir, this is a reputable...
Well, ask for the number.
Okay.
Is there anything aftermarket on the car, like an alarm?
No,
or stereo?
It's straight, you know. It's just straight, and it's, you know, always up until the time we got it, I guess it's, you know, been running pretty well. It's in very good shape and everything.
Right.
And they always check for a draw is the first thing you do, and they never found it. Some of them have kept it for a few days. And each time, you know, they get out, no draw starts. And the people I've been with for a long time said that's the way the world is with relay switches, and that there's, you know, innumerable number of them, and they didn't slice the idea. I was hoping that some way they could, you know, bring it down to, like, you know, five or six things. You know, I was getting to the place where I just start replacing them because my wife will not give this car up. She loves it. And my idea was to trade it in and get another one, but that hit a blank wall.
That's
so...
Right.
If there's anything at all you can suggest, you know, I'm at the place where I'll give it a try.
Well, it sounds like it's obviously an intermittent problem.
Yep.
So if they can't seem to find it or duplicate the problem, there's a simple solution. There's a what they refer to as a battery isolator.
Yeah.
And you put it in series between the battery and the vehicle.
Okay.
And if the battery voltage drops down to a certain value, I don't remember the exact number because it varies with manufacturer to manufacturer, it has a relay internally within this isolator unit, and it opens the circuit between the vehicle and the battery.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get in the car and turn the key, and if that circuit opened, you'll turn the key, and obviously you'll have no dash lights, you'll have nothing. And what you do is you step on the brake pedal, and it reactivates that circuit, completes the circuit, and then the car starts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of hard, you know, it could be something along the lines of an alternator-related problem. Sometimes when they do these things, I've run into them too, they can get very frustrating because they're so time-consuming. Unfortunately, from their standpoint, they can't really bill you for every hour they've got in the project.
Yeah.
So they'll just, you know, and everybody does the same thing. You check the basics, and if it doesn't duplicate, then, well, sir, I'm sorry. The only suggestion I might have to you is that you make sure all the, whatever you're doing when you last drive the car, you always do the same way.
Okay.
You know, make sure the glove box door, you know, the lights aren't on. You have it in the garage at night?
No, it's outside.
Sits outside. Well, you might walk outside every once in a while and see if you see a light anywhere that's come on. Sometimes when there's a drain, particularly if it's an alternator in particular, if you just put the back of your hand on it, it'll be kind of warm.
Mm-hmm.
But a quick solution is what I mentioned, is that isolator.
And it's called the battery isolator?
Right.
Okay, I mean, if I go go to my friendly Buick dealer. He's got the car now. I say, can you guys put a battery isolator?
Well, he'll understand.
He'll understand.
General Motors, to my knowledge, doesn't manufacture one. It's all aftermarket.
All aftermarket.
Yes. So you might call your local parts store and ask them.
Okay.
Most of your major battery manufacturers
offer
them as well.
Okay. Yeah,
but that would
be a nice,
that
be
would
a nice
end
boy
your,
there,
yeah. Yeah, that would end your problem.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot. Okay.
All right, thank you. I'll keep going here. The next caller would be on line number 2, and that brings us here back to Urbana. Hello.
It does, and the problem is a mouse that died in my car.
A mouse?
Yes. Well, I assume it was a mouse. I don't think it was anything larger. I mean, I know it pulled yarn up under the dashboard. I put mothballs on. My car guy suggested putting mothballs on the vents.
Right.
And I think that actually that's what killed the mouse. But after that smell went and the flies went, there's still sort of a residual mouse smell that I've noticed again now.
Right.
I mean, the dead mouse smell.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah, any ideas for...
What they need to do is remove the blower motor.
Okay.
For your heating air conditioning system.
I didn't want you to say that.
Well, it's not that bad.
Okay.
It's not as involved as you think.
All right.
Have them remove that and look up inside that ductwork and clean it.
Okay.
And then you can buy different fresheners to minimize the odor. You can put baking soda under the seats. Just cut the lid open of the boxes and put them under there. What I find works quite well is I buy a can of Lysol, just the plain stuff that doesn't have any odor to it.
Yeah.
And start the vehicle up, put the fan on high, and then at the base of the windshield where your windshield wiper blades are, there's those little black grates that go across there. That's the inlet for the air conditioning and the heating system. And then just start spraying that Lysol there, and it will draw it right into the engine or the passenger compartment.
What a great idea.
And it will... In effect, if there's any mildew or anything like that, it'll take care of that as well, too.
But de-mouse it a bit.
But they've got to get the mouse out.
Well, my guess is that once the flies finish, there isn't a lot of mouse left.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
Oh, you know better than me. All right, blower, motor.
Yeah, they just need to remove the blower motor and get up in there. And I usually use a vacuum cleaner. So I don't have to touch anything.
Okay, good. And then just spray at the bottom of the windshield wipers on the outside with flavorless.
While it's running, with the fan on high.
The fan on high. Mm-hmm. I'll do it. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks very much. So that also would take care of that mildew smell that sometimes you get?
Mm-hmm.
We do that same thing.
Okay. Right. Usually the mildew smell occurs in the summer.
Yeah.
And it's because the air conditioning drain is restricted or even plugged up. You know, there's some cars you literally go around a corner and you can hear water sloshing in the dash, and it's because of the drain. So when you shut your car off in the summer, you should see water dripping out, and usually it's on the passenger side, about where the passenger's feet are, approximately in that area. That's normal. But if you don't see that, then you will get that smell.
And is that relatively easy to clean out if that's plugged up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it should be easy for anybody to make sure that they can tell that that's water that's dripping and not something, one of the other fluids from the car.
Right. It's all the other fluids typically in the car have a significant color, either red or green or yellow. The only one that's fairly clear in color is brake fluid.
Oh, okay.
And some power steering fluids.
All right. Next, we have a caller in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Rick, I don't have a mouse, but I have a similar odor problem. Okay. I have a 1994 Dodge Intrepid, and last year I was having a problem with musty odor when I turned on the air conditioner or the heat.
Right.
And I brought it to the dealer, and they checked the air conditioning system for leaks, and they found the evaporator dryer to the H valve line and the H valve leaking. They replaced the air conditioner evaporator, the line dryer and expansion valve, and they recharged the system and monitored it. And, it seemed all right for a little while, but then I noticed that when I turn on a defrost, I get that musty odor, and it's gotten increasingly worse. Now, before I brought the car to the dealer, I had sprayed some anti-mildew at the base of the windshield, as you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that, well, that seemed to work for a couple days, but then it didn't. That's why I brought them in. And now, you know, I told them that, you know, I was still having some problem. They said, well, they didn't understand because they had, you know, checked everything out. So I noticed, you know, now I still have it when I turn it on defrost. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, the first suggestion is, or thought, is that the drain for the evaporator is restricted and the water's not being able to exit out the bottom of the car when
uh-huh.
you have the air conditioning on.
Uh-huh.
So I would make sure that's clean, clear. And that would be really about the only thing that I can think of. I mean, there's obviously water that's accumulating in there.
Uh-huh. And any reason why it would be with the defrost only seems to come on with the defrost?
Well, in the winter, that's when you turn on the defrost,
uh-huh.
the air conditioning compressor turns on as well.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the other modes, it's not. So that, I don't know, maybe it may have something to do with the location of the moisture, the location of the mildew.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It sounds like an evaporator drain problem.
Okay, so I should check the evaporator for, see if it's restricted, huh?
The drain is where the water comes out.
Uh-huh.
And that'll come out the bottom of the car.
Yeah, so I used to saw that occasionally, you know, I remember there used to be some water on the garage floor at the bottom of the car.
That's what's supposed
and
to
I be. Haven't seen that lately.
Right, and that's would explain your problem.
Uh-huh.
The water's still in there.
Okay. All right, so check and have that looked at.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
You're welcome.
All right, very good. We are at our midpoint already here with Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He's good enough to stop by here several times a year and answer these kind of questions. So if you're having a problem with your car, call in and tell us about it. 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Savoy, line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Hi, Rick.
Hi.
I have right now I have a train going by. I hope it doesn't.
That's okay.
I have a 91 C1500 pickup, and every time I start the car and shut it off, there's a flap in the heater area that claps, like, for about 5-10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of thinking it was a vacuum problem, but I wouldn't know how to go about fixing that.
Yeah, you're right. It's a vacuum problem. When you drive the truck and you accelerate, let's say you have it on defrost,
mm-hmm.
and if you accelerate kind of moderate to hard, does it stay on defrost or does it start switching to the dash vents or coming out by your feet?
I've never noticed a change.
Okay. Because the reason I ask, there's a reservoir that's supposed to maintain vacuum, but the primary component also is there's a check valve, and the check valve is between the vacuum supply and the heating air conditioning system.
Okay.
But if you're hearing a flapping noise, that's a diaphragm that's allowing a flap to move. What I would do is verify that when you go to defrost, it truly goes to defrost, meaning
okay.
all the air comes out the vents, none comes out the dash, none comes out by your feet.
Okay.
And then go to vent and bi-level and heat, and make sure everything switches properly.
Okay.
And if everything switches properly, chances are all the diaphragms and everything are okay, and then I would be looking at that check valve.
Okay. And could you tell me where it's located?
It would be out under the hood.
Under the hood?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And do you think I have a couple of books, you know, like tune-up books and stuff,
mm-hmm.
would I be able to find it in there so I'd know what I'm looking for?
If you find a vacuum schematic for the heating air conditioning system,
mm-hmm.
it should be shown in there.
Okay.
Basically, what the check valve is, it's a one-way valve. It allows vacuum to go one way and not the other way.
Okay.
So if you remove the valve, obviously if you blow and draw on it, you'll be able to check the internal seating of the valve.
Okay. Right. And what is the valve called again?
It's just referred to as a check valve. They're usually fairly small. They're maybe the size of a nickel.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, very good. Let's see. We'll go next over to Crawfordsville, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, Rick. I just wondered if it would be okay and not hurt anything to use jumper cables and jump an old 6-volt battery on a farm tractor with my pickup truck, which is 12-volt battery. Do you harm anything there, and can you get that done okay?
Well, it's not a good idea, obviously.
Uh-huh.
But it years ago, I don't know, just to kind of relate something to you, some of the older Volkswagens used to be all 6-volt.
Uh-huh.
And I used to convert a lot of them to 12-volt for people, uh-huh, which would involve changing all the bulbs, obviously, and the generator. But the one thing I never changed was the starter.
Uh-huh.
They seem to survive the 12 volts fine. So my point to you is that if you want to do that, obviously I'm not recommending it, but if you do want to do it, make sure everything is off. Obviously, the starter is going to spin really fast. But
so
most battery chargers will charge 6-volt.
Okay.
So that would be the best thing to do.
Is there a way to tell just from looking at the battery whether you got a 6-volt or a 12-volt? I've got an old truck out here that had a battery with 4 holes for the water, and I always just looked at if a battery had 3 holes to put the electrolyte in, that was 6-volt, and 12-volt had 6.
Correct.
What if you see a battery that's got 4 holes in there?
I don't know. It's some farm implement battery of some kind.
There's no way to tell. Most vehicles would be a 12-volt. I've got an old 64 pickup truck. That would probably be a 12-volt.
It should be, I would think.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right, well, thanks very much.
You're welcome. All right, thank you. Over to Ashcombe for next person here, line 1. Hello.
How you doing, sir?
Good.
I'm calling in. I got a 99 Chevy Silverado, 5.3 liter, and I switched to K&N air filter. I got the Magnaflow exhaust. I got the Bosch 4-prong spark plug, and I also got the roll tarp, and I'm trying to get the best fuel mileage I can. What other recommendations would you have besides the ones I've already covered to boost my fuel mileage the way the gas prices are right now? I need the most I can get.
Did you change the intake between the mass airflow sensor and the throttle body, or just put a filter on in it?
No, I just put a filter on there. That's it. I just a regular K&N air filter.
Okay. What, you're not getting 16?
I bought right in between 15 and 16 with all that I got now.
Yeah, that's about all you're going to get.
Well, that's about it?
Yeah. I've got the same truck.
All right, because I traveled 36 miles to and from work.
Right.
So I was like, okay. All right, I had to ask. I didn't.
Okay.
I watched a truck in the TV show and stuff, and I saw them recommend something about they got a computer where you can change your timing and stuff.
Yes.
And that would increase your fuel mileage, but I don't know anybody where I'm actually. I'm not from Ashcombe. I'm just loading my truck here, my semi, so I'm from Iowa, and I don't know anybody around there that does that with the computer.
Yeah, I think the most I've heard people get with the newer ones is some have gotten 17 or 18, and that's kind of unusual, but most everybody I've talked to is 16.
Okay.
So you're not far off. Of course, your right foot has a lot to do with that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I appreciate your time.
All right, thanks very much. So what you're saying is that the speed at which you drive will will have some influence on the mileage you get.
Correct. Some vehicles are really funny, though. I had a truck, and if you went 65, the mileage really wasn't that good. But if you went 85 or 90, it got better.
Yeah, it was. Now that's not supposed to work that way.
It's not supposed to work that way. So I don't know. Vehicles are a lot like people. You can have 5 people and they all have the same car and they all get different mileage. And
okay.
Hard to say.
All right. Bloomington, Illinois, I think is up next. Line 2, right here. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Yeah. Got a question for you. You talked earlier about fuel additives and stuff, and whenever I go to the local auto stores, I'm always a little bit confused about regular fuel additives and oil additives, for that matter, as opposed to ones that have synthetic particles in them. And I drive a 98 Camry. My wife drives a 2000 Mazda Protege. And these are the first times we've gotten away from our college cars, which were mid-80s Toyotas. And we kind of want to get as much longevity out of these as possible. So do you, either way, on the regular versus synthetic additives for gas or oil, and do you recommend even an additive in the oil system?
No, I don't.
Okay.
The only additive I suggest is fuel injector cleaner four times a year. Generally, synthetics are better than petroleum-based products, but my perspective on it is that if oil additives were so good and they did everything that they advertise, that if I was a manufacturer of a vehicle, I'd put it in every car, because if it does what it's supposed to do, that my warranty claims should drop significantly. So if I add a bottle to every car and it only costs me $2, but yet I save a significant amount of money over the long run, then that tells me that if it was right, that all the dealers would be doing it. So that's why I don't recommend them.
Okay, but with fuel additives, though, the ones with synthetics are generally better than just petroleum-based ones only.
What kind of additive are you referring to here?
I saw one. I don't know if I mentioned manufacturers. It talked about Tecron, and it had...
just talking about... Tecron is one of the best.
Okay, yeah, just talking about a fuel additive for the gas tank. Yeah, there was one. I was confused about whether, and the people at the auto shop kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, they didn't know which one they would recommend either way, but...
My number one recommendation is Tecron.
Okay, and just once every season then, really no need to do it more than that?
No, there is not.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
All right, thanks. What does that do?
The Tecron?
Yeah.
It's just a real high-quality fuel injector cleaner.
Oh, okay.
It's really good stuff.
Yeah.
We use different kinds. We have some Tektron at the shop, and we have just kind of a conventional I refer to. And if the car really isn't having any problems and it's just a normal maintenance, every maintenance that we perform, we add fuel injector cleaner to the car. Now, if we have a problem with injectors, and we'll always use the Tektron because it works so much faster.
Is that a lot more expensive?
Yes,
than
it's, oh,
okay.
It is a lot
so
more expensive.
So you're saying if you're going to do that, you would stick by your four times a year, but one of those four times you would suggest spend the extra money, buy this one, or no?
No, you don't have to, only if you have a problem.
Okay. Okay. If you think you have a problem.
Correct.
Then, all right. Otherwise, it doesn't pay to spend that much extra money.
No, it
money.
Doesn't.
Okay. And nothing else that somebody would try to sell to put in the gas tank or add in with the oil, you would say, save your money. You don't think it's worth
doing. I don't. Because of the way I tried to explain the manufacturer's perspective.
Right. What about gasoline, particularly octane? Choice. And can it make a significant difference in price between the highest one and the lowest one.
Right.
Is that really going to make very much difference in how the car performs, do you think?
Yes, if a vehicle requires, in the owner's manual it specifies that it needs 91 octane, you have to stay with that. You can try some 89. The downfalls to it are spark knock or detonation, and that is something that you would hear on a hard acceleration. It sounds like somebody put marbles in a coffee can and starts shaking them. Some people refer to it as pinging. And, of course, that is a bad condition because that's actually potentially can damage the engine internally. But in some cases, people that have always used 91 octane on some vehicles, and I've looked at the literature, and I've told them to try 89 or 87. I mean, a lot of times what happens is they actually get better mileage. The lower octane fuels aren't as volatile as the higher octane fuels. So sometimes it does help mileage. The bottom line is when people ask me that question, I just simply say, if you've always used 91, try 89 and see how it is for a while. And if it seems all right, then maybe try 87. Mm-hmm. And either it'll be pretty obvious. You'll have starting problems. You'll have detonation or spark knock that I referred to earlier. And then you need to go back up to the next grade. So it's basically 91 or 93, then you have like 89, and then 87 is the lowest.
Yeah. Okay, so if people want to try, they can try going down one, seeing how the car responds.
And monitor your fuel mileage at the same time. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes you'll be surprised.
All right. Let's talk with somebody here next in Danville, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
This is another question about something that happens in an intermediate fashion. I have a Chevy Venture van at 2000, and there is an intermittent shimmy as I drive that is felt in the vehicle, most noticeable on the highway at about 50+. It doesn't seem to be diagnosable. When I take it in, mechanic drives it. He says that he can feel it sometimes, but it is not at a rate of happening that will allow him to detect what the problem is. So if that's enough information, why is there a way to diagnose this without developing the shimmy to a greater extent?
As far as the shimmy is concerned, does it occur as you're accelerating?
No, it's as you're driving it.
So if you put the cruise control on.
That's right.
That's when you feel it. Now, do you feel it in the steering wheel? Do you feel it in the seat? Do you
feel it in the car? The person sitting in the passenger front seat can feel it.
Okay. But you don't feel it at all in the steering wheel?
I would say no.
Okay. Then I would suspect the first thing to look at, obviously they've looked at the tires if you've...
Tires are brand new.
Right. Then I would say it has to do with the drivetrain that they need to look at.
Is there any other... because, you know, these are GM people.
Right. I understand.
And they say, you know, I just can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me that there are options as to what it could be.
Well,
are there others that you can think of?
No, because generally anything above 45 mile an hour and vibration related is typically associated with tires. So the number one thing to do would be to rotate the tires and then go drive it. You have, in this case, what you have to do is you have to start eliminating things. And then you'll eventually get to the source of the problem. A lot of the General Motors dealerships have a tool. It's a tremendous tool. And it monitors vibration by different sensors. And you mount these sensors around on the car and you go drive it. And it will actually isolate, for example, left front, left rear, middle of the car, wherever you put the respective sensors.
Mm.
And they may have that tool because I know the local dealer does have it.
So it is not a single tool, but a series of sensors.
Correct. That all hook up to a monitor.
Okay. Well, the garage that I am going to now is a GM garage. It's not a dealership, though.
Mm-hmm.
So he should have known about this.
Well, you could ask him. I mean, he probably doesn't have the tool. Maybe he knows someone that does.
Okay, if I went on and said that it did occur in the steering wheel as well, that would mean it would be the front suspension or something?
In the tires, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if you're driving at that speed, sometimes if you set your hand on the floor of the vehicle, I'm assuming now, that you can actually feel it. That's why I was asking if you felt it in your seat or in your feet or in the steering wheel. I was trying to isolate things.
Yeah.
So as much of that information as you can provide is helpful.
So it's either in the drivetrain or the tires, and by saying it occurs in the vehicle,
tells me
not the steering wheel says it's in the
drivetrain.
Drivetrain,
right.
And this is not necessarily a safety problem.
Well, I think
I've been told we go periodically on trips of about 800 miles duration,
mm-hmm.
and we've been told, no, it's okay. It's not going to hurt anything.
Okay, well, then it's not a safety issue. Another quick question. When this vibration, is it worse when you first get on the interstate?
No, it doesn't develop until about after 20 miles or so.
Oh, okay, all right.
It starts between Danville and Champaign, so I know it starts less than 50 miles,
right.
But it's about 20 miles that starts up.
I would be looking at the drivetrain.
Now, is it a matter of there's something wrong in the drivetrain and you have to drive it to figure out what it would be, or?
That's why I think if you can find someone that's got those tools, look at areas of the drivetrain that are lubricated, meaning that as you drive it for 20 miles, the lubrication, when you first take off, the lubricant is very thick, or the viscosity is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And as it rotates and rotates and rotates, of course, it generates a little heat, so that lubricant becomes thinner and thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And as it becomes thinner, if there's a clearance problem somewhere, obviously that clearance increases, and it's magnified over time because the lubricant has thinned, and that's why it's so hard for them to figure it out.
That we bought this used. We've had it since August,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't happen initially.
Right.
So it's developed since then.
Right.
And
so those are my suggestions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. We have here as our guest Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He's generally here with us every season. We do the show, and we have about 10 minutes left. We'll take as many calls as we can. And the next person up in line is in Piatt County, and that'll be line number 4.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
I have a Subaru 97 SVX, and a couple of years ago I noticed when I was driving, it seemed to have a heavy noise. It didn't sound like, I guess it would be the drivetrain, and I took it in, and the guy just drove with me for a couple of minutes and said, it's your bearings. And so they replaced them, but my question is, I'm starting to hear that noise again, so I would just like some information. Since I didn't ask them at the time, it's like, are the bearings in each wheel? Can they go bad again in a couple of years? I just really am so ignorant of this, and would just like some information on that.
So it was definitely a wheel bearing, as you remember? A front one?
It was a rear.
A rear. Did they replace both of them or just one?
Just one, I believe.
Okay, so it's probably the other one now. The wheel bearings, do you understand what they are?
No, I
okay.
don't.
Okay, all right. They basically allow the tire to rotate.
Uh-huh.
You're kind of, do you roller skate or your kids or anything?
Uh-huh.
Okay, they've all got wheel bearings basically in the center of their wheels there. And when you have a wheel bearing that's bad on a car, if you go down the road and straight and then start weaving, in other words, weave to the left, weave to the right, as you load and unload a bad wheel bearing, it will become louder and become quiet. And you can actually isolate. That's how I determine which one it is.
Okay.
So you can do the same thing. Just find a smooth road and just start weaving.
Okay.
And you'll be able to tell which side it's coming from.
And how much does that cost on an average?
Oh, I don't know. Everything price-wise is different as far as parts and you know, the labor without looking it up. I
just hoping.
No, it's almost impossible to keep track of all the pricing for everything.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your information.
Sure.
All right. Very good. We'll go back here to Urbana. Line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for Rick. I want to get back to injectors. I have an old truck. I mean, a 1984 Ford. It's a 3/4 ton, but it's a diesel. Are you okay with diesel engines?
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. And it's kind of an occasional vehicle. That is to say, maybe we use it once a month during the summer, maybe 3 or 4 times a month. And it's running okay. We had it repaired at Prairie, you know, International a few times. So, but I was wondering, you mentioned about this something to put into the tank.
Right. They make them for diesels as well.
Okay. So I could put that in, say, now, right?
Right.
and run it. What is the name of that stuff?
Well, it's a fuel injector. For diesels, what it is, is it does several things. It helps clean the injectors. It helps get rid of the system of moisture. And it's also supposed to help in terms of fuel gelling.
Okay.
But it comes in a quart can, basically.
Do you just put the whole quart in?
No, it depends on how big the gas tank is. It'll have directions on the container.
All right.
But in your case, I would do that. And then every fall, since you're using it so little, I would probably change the fuel filter.
Yeah, it'll commonly sit for maybe a couple months, especially during the winter when we're not very active out there.
The fuel filter, the bottom of the fuel filter will have like a little drain to remove the water. And that's, in theory, that's where it's supposed to end up. So that's why I always recommend every fall that you change the fuel filter on diesels, because if there's water in there, you'll get it out of the system before winter hits.
And then it freezes.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
All right. Is there a name of this stuff that you can recommend? Or
no, I don't. I knew you were going to ask that.
I can ask the guys at Prairie.
Yeah, they probably have it on the shelf. I mean, you can. Most all the parts stores have it.
Okay.
Specifically for diesel.
And it's a diesel mixture for cleaning and
clean the injectors.
All right.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Same thing if you have a car, you're going to and you use conventional gasoline, you're going to do the injector cleaner. Is that, again, how much of it you put in depends on how big the gas tank is, or is that more of a – so you got to know how big your tank is.
Approximately, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you should have a full tank, right, when you run this stuff through?
That's what they recommend. Yeah. Sometimes if a car's got some problems, I – purposely will dump a whole bottle in, even if it's only got a quarter of a tank, just to kind of increase the concentration a little bit.
Okay. Okay, let's talk with Atlanta. Line two. Hello.
Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I have another additive question. Must be an additive day today.
Well, that's okay.
Okay. I drive a 1953 car some of the time. And I noticed the other day when I was in my parts store, they had a lead additive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went ahead and bought some because it seemed like the prudent thing to do. Is it necessary to add a lead additive to an older car with the valves that are not designed to run without it?
Yes.
Okay. That answered my question. So just go by the bottle and add the appropriate amount and make sure I do that.
Right. The only ones that don't require the lead additive, meaning the older vehicles, are the ones that have... What the lead additive is for is to lubricate the valve seat and the valve face, because they're both the same material, the cast iron. Some of the vehicles have what they referred to as a stellite valve seat insert in the cylinder head, and those do not require the lubricant.
How would you determine?
You just have to consult the owner's manual. You may have to do a little research in the cylinder head design. If you, in your particular vehicle, if you can't find that information by putting the lead in there, you're not hurting anything.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I called. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks. So in modern gasoline that's unleaded, did they put something else in there to perform that same function? Or is the car different and it doesn't need that anymore?
Well, it's that and the fact that with the advent of emission controls. Obviously, everybody knows lead is dangerous.
Yeah.
So, and catalytic converters, they don't live very long with lead because it coats. The lead actually gets in the converter and coats and restricts it.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the oxygen sensors. I have a kind of a hard time with race cars with oxygen sensors. I run oxygen sensors on race cars just to monitor the air-fuel ratio in the exhaust, but I'm using leaded fuel. Well, it ruins them. So you just have to, when they don't respond and they become very, very sluggish, you just have to replace the sensors.
Okay. So. Okay. We got time at least for maybe one more call, at least. Go to Atwood, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my car radio. I have a 1999 Jetta. And when I bought it, the AM radio didn't work super great, but it still worked. And then I moved to the country. And now I can't seem to get WILL very often, even during the day when they have high power. And this has been going on for a long time, but last week, now it's affected my FM radio.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I notice is that when I'm trying to listen to the radio, and I blink, I put on my blinker,
right.
The blinker sounds really loud.
When
I accelerate, it seems like that's connected to the radio. And so I can't quite figure out what to do with this thing.
Well, the first thing to do is to make sure that the antenna is tight. The antenna has to be grounded. Sometimes you can wiggle, like if you sit in the car and start the car up and put it on WILL and have somebody wiggle the antenna and see if that changes things. Obviously, when they grab the antenna, they're going to become part of the antenna.
Oh.
But you should be able to hear as they wiggle it, click, click, clicking type noise through the radio, kind of like with the turn signal.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Right.
Yeah.
But it tells me there's a ground problem with the antenna.
Okay.
Or it needs a new antenna. I mean, is it one of the automatic antennas?
Yeah, I don't really know. It's just sort of in the middle on the roof. I don't really know.
Okay.
Yeah.
But check that.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Well, good luck. And there we're going to have to finish. I'm sorry we have one more person we can't take. But we'll try June. I think we're talking about having you come back.
So. They'll let me know.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks.
Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign, here to answer questions on cars. And we generally try to have him here every season, so you can expect when it comes to be summer, he'll be back.